Getting ready to roll here. Thanks for coming tonight. This is a book that I read some time ago, and I've encouraged other people to read it. And I think it's a good book. It has kind of a pop title to it. It's something you'd expect on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Well, he was on the Oprah Winfrey Show. But anyway, so it's a book that I hope we can get into. There's one thing I want to say is to let people know that I know that everyone in this room is an exceptional person, and that much of this sort of thing probably doesn't apply to you all, and probably none of your very close friends. But we probably know some people who this does apply to, and so we can feel free to talk about that. No one has to defend themselves against it or anything, because I know we're all exceptional people here.
The book is by Warren Farrell. He is a PhD, a professor of psychology, but talks throughout the book about how he has started over 300 women's groups across the nation. Thought it was interesting that a male started 300 women's groups, and he uses that language frequently throughout the book. I know because I started 300 women's groups. The book was written in 1985, I believe, so it's pretty current. When I first started reading it, I thought it was probably written in 1968, but it was pretty current. I read this book because Verlon encouraged me to, and when we were facilitating Sojourn last March, this book kept coming up, so I put it on my reading list this fall. And then unfortunately my husband put it on his reading list too, and so we got into some interesting conversations about it. The content in the book does not reflect the opinions or practices of Holden Village. It does not reflect the opinions and practices of myself. I just want to say that.
Contestant number three.
Are you glad you read it?
Well, as Verlon already mentioned, the book does speak in terms of broad generalizations. I think probably it would be most valuable tonight if we would keep that in mind and not, you know, zero in on, well, this isn't true for all the people I know kind of thing. Because I guess think of it in terms of, you know, for the majority of our society, why does this seem to be true or why doesn't it? Because again, most of us at Holden are here for a variety of reasons, because we're out of the mainstream of society. This book I read after Nancy did, and it's the type of book that for me, the first time reading it, you tend to think, yeah, this is really true, this is true, oh yeah, now everything makes sense. And then I guess in interactions that I've had with Nancy, with Verlon, since then, you know, I've maybe figured out that, you know, it isn't quite all that simple. But I think we can have some fun with it tonight, and that's it.
Okay. So one disclaimer, one sort of disclaimer. I'm not disclaiming nothing. I like the book from beginning to end. And so what we'll do is give an overview of the book. Hopefully that won't take long, and then we'll open it up for discussion. He starts off in the introduction of the book talking about power includes lovability as well as a number of other things. When people talk about power, they don't often include lovability. Men are more lovable when they feel understood, and oftentimes men go feel not understood. Men have found that if they want to be involved with a woman sexually, we should mention intimacy more and sex less. True vulnerability, acknowledging your kind of your whining side, acknowledging the things that don't work or don't go right for you, that's what being vulnerable is all about. And men have learned that women don't accept that part of us. Women don't accept the vulnerable side of us. We're labeled as wimps, and oftentimes we're shut down for this. Men's feelings are called sexist, chauvinist, too aggressive. We learn that some of our feelings are not acceptable as well. He talks about some of the things that men are, that women talk about, that men are, that we don't listen, that we objectify women. And he has this thing here that says that there are 150 steps from when you see a woman and make eye contact till you get to the point where you're sexual. And that men in our society initiate all 150 of those steps. And if men don't initiate those steps, then he learns rather quickly that he could be rejected for that. He did this thing where he got women to take those steps and these women began to feel what the men felt and began to pick up some of those same traits in terms of asking a man out, making the first move on a man, asking several men out in order to get one date, and that kind of thing. He talks about, and he also did this thing where the men were supposed to be in a beauty contest, and that they were categorized, and how it felt for the men when only one of them won and the others lost, clearly because they weren't as attractive as the other man. And he talks about this a lot, kind of walking each other in each other's shoes like that. Let's see, what's another one? To understand, we must walk in each other's shoes. So that's kind of the preference. And then I'll start with the first section of the book. There are five sections of the book. I'm taking 1 and 5, Nancy's taking 2, and Carl's taking 3 and 4. And he has this list of power, what power is defined at. And I didn't go through the list. It's only 5 things. I should have written it down, but there's other stuff, so. If we want to know, I can get back to those. But one of the things he talks about is in the arena of interpersonal contact, affection, love, that kind of stuff. He says men and women experience about the same thing. But one of the things he brings out is that in the area of physical health, and he has this long list here of women, he says, women fare better than men on the average. Women live 7 to 8 years longer than men. Men suffer over 90% of the major 98% of the major diseases. Some of this may be biological, but since the gap has increased in the United States by almost 700% since 1970, let's see, where is it? That 600% higher incidents were work-related. Many of our deaths and injuries are work-related. 2 million disability injuries, 14,000 deaths per year. We can see that a good portion of this difference is due to sex role assignments in the workplace. It is in the area of physical health and longevity that men's power, control over their own lives, begins to fall considerably short of women's power. There can be no greater loss of power than the loss of your own life. And then he talks about our reaction to this is we tend to feel more sorry for the widows who are left behind than for the men who have lost their lives. And then he talks about the conditions that men have and the conditions that women have. It's her 9 conditions, his 1 condition. To get involved with a woman, a man basically, she has to be attractive. But that's the man's 1 condition. women have 9 conditions. and they're sexually cautious until these conditions, until 3 or 4 of these conditions are met. A man has to be attractive. She has to respect him. He has to be, attraction, respect, emotions, intelligence. Many women add a 5th and 6th condition, singleness, status, success. Many add 7th, 8th, and 9th. A man must ask her out, he must pay, and he must risk rejection by initiating the first kiss and all those 150 other things. Men are socialized to want sex as long as only one condition is fulfilled, the physical attraction things. What's another one? Women end up finding fewer men who meet all of these 9 conditions, and then they say, why aren't there any more good men around? And he talks about that women generally marry up and men marry down as far as the social economics in our country is concerned. And men, he says that men have a lower, obviously men have a lower expectations, and that we've internalized that low expectations. Many of us don't even go beyond that. We feel so happy if she's good looking that we don't, the other stuff, you know, we don't even bother with. And his reasoning for this, if we got to initiate everything, these 9 reasons plus the 150 other initiating things, nothing would ever happen. He talks about men don't articulate this powerlessness because men are conditioned to perform, and men have to perform in many, many ways to get women's attention. And he talks about, not that kind of performance, he talks about, he has an example of Neil Diamond, and at one of Neil Diamond's concerts, Neil Diamond yells out some girl's name from high school and said, you wouldn't even talk to me in high school, look at me now, you know, and that men feel this need to perform and to take the risk in order to get the woman's attention, to let the women know that they are indeed moving up, marrying up, if they get involved with this guy who's going to take all the risk and do all these wonderful things. And he talks about men's incentive for changing needs to come from redefining power. It comes with understanding their experience of powerlessness. While not denying the female experience of powerlessness, men do not change by being persuaded that one component of power means men have the power. That just keeps men blind to power. So he's basically saying that our power has been defined as financial power, and in other ways that we are rendered powerless. And so that's the first chapter.
I took notes on part 2, and the reason I took notes is so that I didn't give my opinion versus just what he said. So once again, I just want to say I'm not necessarily in agreement with this. Part 2 of the book is called Women of Change, Why Aren't Men Changing Too? He says that men have adapted to women as women have adapted to men. Women think they're powerless, men feel powerless sexually. He goes on in this section to talk about men's primary fantasy, which you can guess what that is.
What is it?
Versus the female's primary fantasy. And he gets this idea about primary fantasy from magazines. The number 1 and 2 magazines sold, and it's well over 4 million apiece in the U.S., are for men. Playboy and Penthouse. Outsell all men's magazines. They represent men's primary fantasy, which is access to as many beautiful women as desired without risk of rejection. Women's primary fantasy, he says, is reflected in the two best-selling women's magazines. Getting close. Better Homes and Gardens and Family Circle. Both of those over 9 million subscribers, so they double the men's magazines. From that information, the author says that this represents women's primary fantasy, which is family and security. Primary fantasy for men, access to many beautiful women, and women, family, and security. He says that both sexes would like to have it all. An intellectual partner, a sexually exciting partner, a provider, provide security. They want them to be a 10, but not self-centered, offers unconditional love, pushes our boundaries, fulfilling job, yet time with family, income, and plenty of time to spend it. We want it all. He says, what distinguishes us are different fantasies that the other sex can provide for us. Women, their fantasy is that the man can provide security, income. Men, the primary fantasy is that the woman can provide sex. Once again, he uses magazine sales and he also uses book sales to get some of his information. So, of the top magazines sold to women, 6 of 11 are traditional magazines like Better Homes and Gardens, Family Circle, Ladies Home Journal. The magazines that are what we know as women's magazines that we would have here, what we have Ms., maybe Women of Power, those have very low circulation and didn't even come close. And then he uses romance novels, things like Harlequins, Danielle Steele, so on. Romance novels sell 40% of all paperback books, every paperback. And of those buyers, they're women, and women who are employed. It's interesting. How do women achieve their primary fantasy? How do women get someone who will provide for them and, let's see, family and security? He says, females' primary means to their first fantasy is glamour, beauty, and men. Over 90% of women's magazines focus on this, almost nothing on career. And he has a long section in the book where he has advertisements from leading women's magazines, and the ads focus on beauty, perfumes, makeup, suntan things, diets, diamonds, jewelry, almost nothing on career. And at the time when he wrote this book, even Ms. magazine, the advertisements in Ms. Fell into this category. Now I believe Ms. has no advertising. Let's see. For men, the second ranking best-selling magazine reflects their means to their primary fantasy. In other words, how do men get what they want from women, sex, in other words? Well, those magazines, you might guess, are Sports Illustrated, Forbes, and Boy's Life, Start Them Young.
Was that his comment?
That's his comment. And what are these magazines about? They're about heroism and they're about performance. Men have to perform to get what they want for women. They have to stand out, like Verlaine said in the Neil Diamond concert. He had to be up there in front of a million people to say to the one person in seventh grade that rejected him, "Look at me now." The greater the magazine emphasis on independence, equality, working, career for women, the lower the circulation. I said that earlier. He He gives some differences in the types of magazines that are available for men and women. I didn't write them all down, but one made a good point. He said, there's a bride's magazine, but there's no groom's magazine. Bride's magazine focuses on women's primary fantasy of security, marriage, family. And many magazines for women talk about the wedding as being the most important day of your life. Women's magazines put that concept forth. He makes the point in the chapter that you wouldn't see that in a men's magazine. The most important day of your life is your wedding and how to prepare for it and so on. Differences in advertising for men's magazines. The advertising deals mostly with success. Computers, office systems, a little bit of clothing, but mostly deals with success. For women, it's glamour, beauty, and how to get a man. He says women's situation has changed in the last two decades, but what they want from men has not. In other words, he says that women have access to education, they have access to careers, but what they really want is family and security and the man to provide that for them. He makes the statement that women will drop out of their career once they get with their partner. And he also says that they gain weight. Okay, chapter 2, what women want. The message the man hears. The message the man hears is that the woman wants money. Once again, the advertising, they talk about advertising for diamonds, and he has two pictures in the book, and they're two identical pictures when you look at them right away. It's a glamorous woman and a handsome young man looking at each other in the eye, and she's got her hand sort of on his face, and she's got her diamond there and says a diamond is blah blah
is forever.
Yes. and one of the ads was from 1975 and one was from 1985, and he says look at the ads and see what the difference is. Well, I looked and looked and looked and I couldn't see the difference. It was the same couple. I thought, my, they haven't aged in 10 years. But they must have used the same couple, but she had a bigger diamond on her hand in the 1985 picture, a much bigger diamond. I think it was like a third of a carat. And the ad for 1985 said, is a third of your income too much to spend for this? And whereas the ad from 10 years prior to that focused on less on cost. What the man spends on the woman is meaningful. He says that there are no gifts for men advertised in women's magazines, not even around Christmas time, but there are lots of gifts for women advertised, what you could want from your man. All right. Why do men say they feel they're getting mixed messages from women? Many men are saying that women want them to share housework. This is true, yes. But only in addition to success and buying a wardrobe and diamonds. In other words, help with the laundry, do the child rearing, do the whatever. What do we fight about? Dishwashing. So on. But they also want the success, the wardrobe and the diamonds. He also talks about the women who appear most often on the covers of popular magazines, Princess Di, Linda Evans, apparently, and she played in Dynasty of kind of Richmond. No, and we're not discussing yet.
No, I meant the women who appear on the magazines was Princess Di,
Princess Grace, Jackie O,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. And he says all of them married the right man for wealth. Talks about how women who are wealthy didn't get there by working. They got there by inheriting their money either from their fathers or from their dead husband. And women think that if they look like a princess, they'll marry a man that is successful and can provide wealth for them. Men are labeled commitment dodgers, but women aren't labeled the commitment giants. He said that many women's magazines, he talks about Self and A Career Woman, I think, when they talk about relationships with men and problems with relationships with men, they label men as commitment dodgers. But his point is that women are never labeled commitment giants, that women want commitment, men feel forced into it to meet their primary fantasy. Women's secondary fantasy, after their primary fantasy is met, family and security, women's secondary fantasy is sexual. But if he doesn't meet the primary fantasy as well, she won't commit. He talks about the club med scene, how women will go to club men and they'll meet some guy and they'll have this sexual relationship with him and it'll be great. But if he's a plumber, they won't do anything with him. That's the example they use.
Sorry. It says Jeff on.
Jeff on. They don't want commit. So their secondary fantasy is sexual. He says that this is the reason why many women who, after they get their family and they get money from their husband, they go out seeking the sexual aspect of their life somewhere else. Okay.
That's where the plumber comes in.
Relegated to the back door again.
The common self-improvement articles in women's magazines, they don't talk about, he says, they don't talk about career, access to education, grants, loans, child care, whatever you need to move your career along. He says the common self-improvement articles in women's magazines talk about self-improvement, beauty, weight loss, how to have it all if you lose 30 pounds, makeovers, all those kinds of things. The magic denominator, he says, is how to be successful without working. Okay. What does romance really mean? If a woman has security but lacks excitement, she turns to female porn. Oh yeah, if there's not excitement in her marriage sexually, he says, the woman turns to female porn. He talks about Playboy and Penthouse as men's porn. Female porn are the paperback books, the romance novels. The message to men is, once the security need is met, she'll be off fulfilling her secondary fantasy with someone else. Okay, and then he gets into talking about the Super Bowl and how for men...
The big stainless steel thing?
Oh, no. The big game. The big game yesterday, yeah. 75 million viewers, I think it was even more that they announced. Mostly men. What is the female version of the Super Bowl? Miss America.
Oh,
really?
75 million viewers of Miss America, same as the Super Bowl. Mostly women, 75%. The Miss Universe pageant, there are 600 million viewers. He says that we, men and women, pay close attention to and study the tools that bring us our primary fantasy. Women watch Miss USA or Miss America because they want to know how to be like that. And men watch the Super Bowl, read Sports Illustrated because they want to know how to be like that. The unfortunate thing is that doesn't bring men power. Men don't feel more powerful because they've watched the Super Bowl and watched so-and-so get most valuable player. It makes them feel powerless. Women don't feel more power by seeing that Miss USA wins the Miss Universe pageant. They feel powerless. They feel less able to be that way, but they continue in that cycle. Oh, here I've written in a little comment of my own. I'll leave that off. All the emphasis on beauty makes women feel inadequate. The irony of power is that both sexes often see themselves as powerless. Women see external rewards as power. Dates, comments about their appearance, comments about their weight loss. Same with men, but it doesn't, same thing with men with power, I said that already. And I'm better able to do my job, I can perform better. Well, he says that if beauty alone gives a woman self-confidence, that men should worry because it makes the woman dependent on something they will have less of with age. So as the woman grows older, their self-confidence will decline, or the plastic surgery bills will go up. A beauty-focused woman, beauty-focused women have the most sexual problems and most strongly deny their sexual problems. That was interesting. Okay. Once again, he's back on ads. He talks about vulnerability. He says that women can get a man by being vulnerable, looking vulnerable, the appearance of vulnerability, then he can perform. And he shows this one ad where there's a attractive young woman skating and she's fallen down. And this, it happens to be that a law student from Yale comes and picks her up. So, mythically, he is rescuing her. He is her hero. He says that in ads, the power tools are sex and the hint of sex. And he also says that the male misuse and abuse of sex has become the emotional topic of the 80s. And he's talking about lawsuits, the Clarence Thomas type thing. He's talking about rape and so on. It's the emotional topic of the 80s. And he says that this is partly because men have learned, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Men have learned that when a woman says no, it means maybe, and maybe means yes. When a woman says no sexually, that it really means maybe, and maybe means yes. And he talks about two particular movies. Let's see, what are they?
Flashdance
with Jennifer Beals. And he talks about Madonna's boyfriend in Desperately Seeking Susan. How the message initially in these movies was, no, I don't want anything to do with you, leave me alone, I'm not interested in you sexually. And they end up getting together anyway, and it comes out that the woman was actually attracted to the man and after him all along. So that gives a message to men that when a woman says no, she really means maybe. Okay. He says that instructions for rape are sitting in most American living rooms at any given moment. And he talks about primarily magazines, magazine articles, and some movies. And then he goes into this movie. Then he talks about something he calls the flash dance phenomena. Talks about it as a mythological theme. Even mentions Joseph Campbell. And this myth is a man competing to get women's attention and avoid her sexual rejection. That's mythological, and we play that out in our own lives. He says that men have to work their whole lives to be successful financially and so on. He said a woman can become successful overnight by ending up with the right guy. Men aren't supermen, and that's what women's primary fantasy wants them to be. So women who talk about they're depressed about real life men because they just there just aren't enough of them, there's no real man out there. They turn to their female porn outlets, he calls them, these novels, so on. His conclusion of this section is, why are there no men? Well, men have their binoculars pointed at major male criteria, attractiveness, And women have their binoculars pointed at their criteria, which is success.
Well, I can tell the crowd's getting somewhat restless here, ready to jump in. Mm-hmm. So I'll try and move things along quickly here so that we can get into the discussion phase of tonight's session. Much of this has been mentioned in previous chapters. In part three, that's the part that's called Why Men Are the Way They Are, and he goes back to adolescence, to where this all starts, with women maturing sooner than men. It starts in junior high, where the young boys, as they're coming into their sexual maturity, they figure out in a hurry that the women their age or older are going out with older men, are not available, and this is at a time when they're thinking about sex most often, their sexual peak being at 18, and then that's how they get started on the success stuff, or the hero stuff, the sports, performing somehow through, if not through athletics, then through other endeavors, but performing to get women's attention, he says, goes back to junior high. And even the language that that men and women use to talk about sex, men quickly find out that their sexuality is worthless compared to women's. Euphemisms for men are getting it, whereas for women, euphemisms about sex are giving it. The connotation that, the women have something to offer sexually and men, men don't. And then in the next chapter, he goes into a little bit about kind of the double bind that men are in, because of what makes them successful career-wise is not what makes them successful at home with either their wife or their children. The hours that they have to keep, the stress that they're under, particularly for top executives or whatever, it doesn't at all make for good home relationships. And then to follow up a little bit with the commitment thing that both Nancy and Verlon brought up earlier, there's kind of a double standard with commitment. I'll just read a little excerpt here where he says that the more successful a man, the less likely his wife is to work, and therefore his daughter is more likely to have as a role model a mother who does not work full time. To compensate for lack of attention, some successful fathers give things to their daughters, creating the message that men give money, you don't have to earn that yourself. He talks about the double bind about there's the term working mother, but there's no such term for fathers. It's assumed that fathers work, and if women are working and are parents, then they're going above and beyond, what's expected of men. In terms of pressure to commit, he talks quite a bit about a lot of the literature that's out now and some of the common pop psychology books, the vast majority of which somehow focus on the inadequacies of men and men's fear of commitment and how women are going to respond to that. He gives several examples here of these kinds of books. The Peter Pan syndrome. When men are afraid to commit, they're accused of not growing up. Those kinds of things. And he says that books from the opposite frame of reference just don't go over well at all. He mentions one that came out that was it was well publicized by a major publisher called Mirror Mirror, that focuses on the subject of which was focused on women's vanity. And he talked about how that bombed, and how any of the books that have to do with men running from commitment or men's fear of commitment go over really well and sell well, as that being kind of the standard that authors have to meet for the marketplace. Okay. Let me skip ahead here to... he blames a lot of the mixed messages on the fact that through society or however, there really is a, you know, there really are the fantasies that are set up that are mutually exclusive. Whether to what extent women are controlled by this and to what extent they control it is not clear, but the idea of female beauty and then the males wanting that, being in direct conflict with the woman's fantasy of a single male that's committed to them. He says yet through all of our advertising that focuses on sexuality and focuses on youth and beauty that it's a lose-lose situation. Okay, and in chapter 7 he even goes on to say that now there's a new sexism that's replaced the old. To where male bashing is in, it's okay to, it's okay to tell jokes about men, but, you know, not the other way around. It's not okay for men to do the opposite. Some examples of the new sexism. He has several articles that are little cartoons that he's copied from women's magazines about this. But he summarizes the new sexism I can't find this where that was. I guess I'll go on with another thing that he goes into is looking at violence and kind of the myth that men are responsible for the violence, and instead puts it in the frame that men are really the victims of violence, in that, you know, like what Verlon mentioned, the ultimate in powerlessness is to lose your life. And because of men's jobs, because of men's society's expectations for men to be soldiers and they lose their lives more often. And then he goes on to talk about in movies, it's commonplace for men to be killed in movies, and it's a much greater sin for a woman to be killed, and that's why all the horror movies, or most of them anyway, focus on, you know, women being killed, because that's seen as such a terrible thing, and then, which it is, but, you know, his argument is that it's not, why is it not equally terrible for men to be killed, the way they portray it in common movies. He also takes a look at the sexual revolution and asks, why did it disappear so quickly? The confusion he talks about, he thinks, has to do with of the sexual revolution running out of gas, in that sex still has a price, sex in many ways is still considered dirty, even though the sexual revolution supposedly dealt with that and people are free of that. But he talks quite a bit about how, because of this commitment thing, there's no such thing as free sex. You know, the expectations are still there for some kind of a follow-up with phone call or a relationship, that's still going on, and that this hurts both men and women. He says that sexual freedom returned to the old sex when sexual freedom could no longer be linked with economic freedom. He says our natural response is to make the competition into the enemy, And that's women now have entered the economic realm more and are competing with men, and they've since become the enemy. Well, I think I'll let Verlon go on at this point and looking at the time that we have left.
Well, we can, since my stuff is kind of stuff that has to do with how some of this stuff can be fixed up. Maybe we'll take questions first, and if we don't automatically get to this, then I'll get back to it. So, any questions or comments? Yes.
I just have a question. Did he back up a lot of his facts in the book? I mean,
yeah, it's loaded with statistics and that kind of thing, footnotes.
But he didn't have it. He got a lot of his information from studying magazines.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not pure research, human research.
Is he married or have a family or anything?
he's divorced and but he talks about his wife and a little bit, his ex-wife, and he has a partner now that has a 8-year-old daughter at the time he wrote this book, and he talks a lot about his relationship with this 8-year-old daughter and how he doesn't want to give her gifts or give her the wrong gift or how to respond to her saying I want to marry Scott Bio someday and those kinds of comments. He talks a lot about that struggle.
Seems like he brings out that men are the inferior ones who feel inferior with this fear of rejection and fear of death and marrying down and what else was there? Only having one criteria, whereas women had 9, they don't look for as much, so they don't set their standards as high, was the message that I just got from him.
Well, it wasn't that men were inferior. I mean, I think his thing was to kind of even it out. I mean, the way society has become, it's like men are looked at as having all the power and women are looked at as having none. And his thing was trying to balance it out and say, no, neither one of us has the market on, you know, on power. Yep.
That one statistic that was what I was kind of talking about. That one statistic kind of bugged me that men marry down or socioeconomically, because in general men make more than women. So if you parallel each person's, like a man and a woman are in the same job, and if you parallel their salaries, the woman's salary would probably be less. But if they would get married, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? That,
well, equal pay for equal work, and if things were equal, then, but.
He says specifically that women marry up and men marry down. Take me, I'm a nurse, so I would marry a doctor. He uses that example. I wouldn't marry an orderly. I did.
That's why she's here.
So he came to hold her.
But he talks about specifically careers or levels in management and so on.
Well, I talked about economics in particular. This comment was good because, I mean, two people can be doing the exact same thing, but given that, the man will earn more necessarily. Mm-hmm. You could, like a doctor can marry a doctor, but the male doctor will be making more money. Yeah. Is he saying that too?
No,
he's saying that the woman's looking up.
If a woman's a doctor, she doesn't marry a doctor.
She marries the head of the department or something like that.
But he could have used the statistics from what we're both saying in his book.
Yeah, he could have.
I have read that men are very uncomfortable in relationships unless they are a little smarter or a little richer or a little whatever. That it's men who take it this way, not women.
Well, his answer to that would be that women lose interest in a man who, if a man comes home and tells a woman that he got fired because he wasn't as smart or didn't work as hard as his companions, why would he come home and tell the woman who was financially dependent on him that's what happened? You know, it's kind of like if he's the provider, he's got to keep this image going, because if he doesn't, then it makes the relationship shaky if their relationship is based on, you know, the fact that he's financially supposed to be the breadwinner and that sort of thing. Does that?
Well, when I read, it's been a while since I read this, but it's like feminist literature is sometimes saying that the man always wants to be superior and is therefore make sure that they pick a woman who's a little dumber and a little inferior to them.
Well, according to this, the man doesn't
I mean,
care.
That's just a different way.
But according to this, the men don't care about the woman being dumb. I mean, you know, if she's good looking, you know, that's part of that's the main criteria, you know, how much she makes, what her intelligence is, some of that other stuff doesn't mean as much.
Go ahead.
What do you think was meant by, and how do you feel about the male sexual peak in 18?
Well, the main point he was trying to bring up there is that in the time when he gives the statistics, you know, a 15-year-old boy thinks about sex, you know, 30 times an hour, that kind of thing, and that during that 30, time...
He says 30 times a minute, I think. It's
yeah, once every 6 seconds.
Yeah, it's unbelievable in that that's the very time when women are most unavailable to them sexually, in that, you know, then they put all this energy into the hero stuff, the success stuff, and you know, that's where a lot of it goes back to.
Do you think he literally means a sexual peak is in reference to how often one thinks about sex per minute?
No, physical capabilities or what have you. Or
he bases it though just on that thought, how often a male thinks about sex. He bases, then says, well, that is their sexual peak. The more you think about it, that must be your peak.
He also talks about what's known as the middle age crisis. And he says, when men are at the peak of their earning power, women are at the peak of their beauty in their early 20s. Men are at the peak of their earning power in their 40s. And so this is when, you know, you hear about the midlife crisis when men are running off with younger women. And his thing is, what crisis? You know, that for the first time in this man's life, he can pick and choose what he wants. And this woman, this man has exactly what she wants, you know, financial support, status, that sort of thing. And that they're at a point where they're both at their peak as far as what people's primary fantasies are. And so,
well, I personally thought that everybody's always, and usually generally, misused the term sexual peak for both men and women, because it's mostly based on emotional, and that seems to be what they're referring to, emotional, the frustration aspect of the young man, mm-hmm. and the same age woman going out with older men. Mm-hmm. But naturally, and in fact, it's based on the sperm count or the egg production.
Well, he's not. He's not talking about sex per se. I mean, he's not talking about intercourse.
Sexual peak is defined by those terms specifically, you know, and they generally use emotional.
Yeah. And he's defining it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's always a misnomer.
He's right? Talking about another peak.
I don't know. Jump in and say that. Put it out. Everybody seems to really enjoy this discussion. And a lot of tittering, lots of fun and laughing. And for me, there was a lot of truth in the book. I mean, just not all of it. It's a lot of it's pretty silly. But I thought that in my own experience as a man, there is a lot of truth in what's being said for me. And I really appreciate the chance to discuss it, even if it, I think it took some courage to pick that book and discuss it, frankly. So that's it was real.
At the risk of sounding politically incorrect, and you're in your 40s, this is the time to read that book. The people in their 20s haven't even lived yet.
Oh.
They've only lived 20 years, 21 years. They haven't been kicked around enough yet to see. I'm not defending the book one bit, but you really have to read this book with an open mind and say, a lot of it is gobbledygook, but there's a lot of food for thought there. I'm not saying it justifies anything, it doesn't, but if you haven't had enough experience yet, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good to sit and titter about it and think that this is all baloney. Wait till you're 40, then read that book, then come back and tell me how many laughs you get out of it.
Well, I'll comment about something that I guess I've lived, about the father-daughter thing, about how the father gives the daughter gifts, and by doing so, it makes it look as if a man is supposed to give women gifts. And, well, I mean, my father gives me gifts, and I like it. But I don't think that's really what he meant when he did it, and he has always told me that I can do whatever I want, and he's never discouraged me any less than my brothers, and he was at every sporting event that I've ever been in, and it just seems to me that's really kind of dumb, because, or at least as far as my specific case goes, I mean, maybe I just have a great dad, but, I mean, I think that.
he talks about on that same thing, he talks about women working for what they get, that learning to work for what they get. And he mentions a thing in there, just an aside. He says, like a woman running for president. He said in the 80s, two black people ran for president, Jesse Jackson and Shirley Chisholm. They went through all the work it takes to run for president. The only white woman who's ever ran for president was appointed, and she didn't go through all the campaigning kind of thing. And he talks about that in terms of that flash dancing kind of thing, also, in the sense that women joke about having a woman run for president, yet two people who are lower on the social economic scale, two African Americans, went through what it takes to run for a president, but a white woman has yet to go through what it takes to run for president.
I wanted to make a comment on what you said. It seems like that it's really depressing men to think about, okay, great, well, what do we have to really look forward to? Can't we have positive ideas about the relationships that come? I mean, it helps me to laugh about this, because then it helps me to know that within this next 20 years, I can change that, I can overcome that stereotype. And it seems also that, I mean, gradually, hopefully, the times, cheesy statement, but the times are changing, you know? And I feel good about, you know, what I'm going to be looking for in someone, or I feel like I have a chance of not being in this book, you know what I mean?
Well, just to let you know about how the times are changing, another big grossing movie was Pretty Woman. And we all know what that was about, you know. This wealthy businessman gets a streetwalker and flash dances her to success. And, you know, it was the same kind of stuff.
Another thing about that movie, how many of you read that book?
Oh,
that
yeah,
movie
totally different.
Yeah, it's a real sad, depressing finale. But they take a movie and they turn it into something else, which is, of course, typical, because they know they won't sell it otherwise. Nobody wants to see a poor woman thrown back out on the street and die of an overdose. But, yeah, that's a good example.
What's disturbing to me is how much adolescents do enjoy movies like that. And I guess that's really the disturbing thing about it, is that then if they're the people of tomorrow, then times aren't changing. Because I would think that would make them mad, you know, a young woman mad, something like that. You know, and if they were changing.
I'd like to add, since I've been at Holden, it's been really wonderful to see the young people come and know that things are changing for a positive benefit. It's really nice to see you people come and see that you have goals and that you're, you know, developing experiences instead of me sitting in my 40s thinking, gee, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. It's really nice to have this experience for me, and I pity the people in our society who don't get a chance to meet the people like you who are positive thinking and who are moving forward and have good ideas and are going to, you know, like you said, make changes. And I didn't mean to offend anybody, but the book, you know, the book generally, I'd say, is pretty light reading. It's a coffee table novel, but it has some basis of information based upon one supposedly capable expert to glean some information for us, just food for thought. And no, I don't want anybody to read the book and think, holy cow, we're still not making any progress, because I think we are. And this is a nice place to see progress happening.
If one's going to look at